Hi, I'm Dennis Daugherty on behalf of the Plymouth Rock Foundation. I have the honor of introducing David Bradford this morning. David Mark Bradford has held leadership positions with various quality, safety, homeschool, and historical organizations for over 20 years and has served as an officer and elder in the Bible Fellowship Church of Newark, New Jersey. As a 12th generation direct descendant of Governor William Bradford and governor of the Mayflower descendants in the state of Delaware, he regularly performs first-person reenactments of Bradford and his writings, as well as he gives lectures on the life and legacy of the historian and governor of the Plymouth Pilgrim Colony. So let's welcome David Bradford.
Good day to you. Good day. It was Wednesday, September 6th, and these troubles being blown over and all now compact together into one ship, we put to sea again with a prosperous wind, which continued divers days together, which was some encouragement to us. Yet, according to the usual manner, many were afflicted with seasickness. And that I may not omit here a special work of God's providence. There was a proud and very profane young man, one of the seamen, of a lusty, able body, which made him the more haughty. And he would always be condemning our poor people in their sickness, and cursing us daily with grievous execrations, and did not let to tell us that he hoped to help to cast half of us overboard before we came to our journey's end and make merry with what we had. And if we were by any gently reproved, he would curse and swear most bitterly. But it pleased God, before we were half sails over, to smite this young man with a grievous disease, of which he died in a desperate manner, and was so himself the first to be thrown overboard. Thus, his curses light on his own head. And it was an astonishment to all his fellows, for they noted it to be the just hand of God upon him. Well, after we enjoyed fair winds and weather for the season, we were encountered many times with cross winds and met with many fierce storms with which the ship was shroudly shaken and her upper works made very leaky. And one of the main beams in the midships was bowed and cracked, which put us in some fear that the ship would be unable to perform the voyage. So some of the chief of the company, perceiving the mariners to fear for the sufficiency of the ship, as appeared by their mutterings, we entered into serious consultation with the master and officers of the ship to consider in time of the danger, and rather to return than to cast ourselves into a desperate and inevitable peril. And truly, there was great distraction amongst the mariners themselves. Fain would they do what could be done for their wages' sake, being now near half-sail over, and on the other hand, they were loath to hazard their lives too desperately. But examining all opinions, the master and others affirmed that they canoed the ship to be firm and strong under water. And as for the buckling of the main beams, there was a great iron screw we brought with us out of Holland, which raised the beam into its place. Which, after being done, the carpenter affirmed that with a post put under it and set firm in the lower deck and otherwise bound, he would make it sufficient. And as far as the decks and the upper works, we caulked them as well as we could. And so we committed ourselves to the will of God and resolved to proceed. In sundry of these storms, the winds were so fierce and so high as we could not bear a knot of sail, and were forced to hull for divers days together. In one of them, while we were
thus in a mighty storm, a lusty young man called John Owlan, coming upon some occasion about gratings, was with a sail of the ship thrown into the sea. But it pleased God, he grabbed hold of the topsail halyards, which hung overboard and ran out at length, and yet he held his oars, for he was simply fathomed under water, till he was hauled up again by the same rope to the brim of the water. Then with a boat hook and other means got into the ship again, and his life saved. And though he was sometime ill with it, he lived many years after, and became a profitable member, both in church and commonwealth. During all of this voyage, there died but one of the passengers, which was William Button, a youth, a servant to Samuel Fuller, as we drew near the coast. But I omit other things, that I may be brief. After long baiting at sea, we fell among that land which is called Cape Cod, to which being made, and certainly known to be it, we were not a little joyful. And after some deliberations with the master of the ship and others, we tacked about and resolved to stand for the southward, the wind and weather being fair, to find some place about Hudson's River for our habitation. And after we sailed that course about after die, we fell amongst dangerous shoals and roaring breakers, and were so far entangled therewith that we conceived ourselves in great danger. And the wind shrinking upon us withal, we resolved to bear up again for the Cape, and considered ourselves happy to have gotten out of the danger before night overtook us, as by God's good providence we did. The next day we sailed into the Cape Harbor, where we reared in safety. And being thus arrived in a good harbor, and brought safe to land, we fell on our knees and blessed the God of heaven, who brought us over this vast and furious ocean, and delivered us from all the perils and miseries thereof, again to set our fate on the firm and stable earth, our proper element. Well, what you've just heard is really Bradford's account of that Mayflower journey over, and also what happened when they first arrived and what they saw. My mission, I'm David Bradford. One of the things I retired about 3 or 4 years ago. I'm sorry, is it not loud? I'm usually quite loud, it seems like, so I didn't notice that until it was back. But one of the things I, let me just, one of the things I wanted to say is that how I got started in this, being a descendant of Bradford, I've always wanted to share, be his mouthpiece. It's something my son and I talked about for years, wanting to really share directly his words and his history without being any kind of a filter. I just wanted to be faithful. He's written some things that I always thought were interesting, and I wanted so desperately to understand and appreciate what he'd written. But if you've ever read of Plymouth Plantation, I don't know about you, but for me, it was a challenge. The long sentences, some of it always writing in the third person, and they and them. I get done with the paragraph, and I'm going, okay, now who are these talking about? Who's they? So it was a challenge. And it was when I decided, he wrote as a like a reporter. He would write things, an account of the history for future generations. So he was dispassionate, he was objective, and he sat back and just wrote about what God wanted him to share with future generations. But I thought, well, if I'm going to be sharing people, giving people a sense of what he was telling me the story, I needed to put this in the first person. And the moment I did that, when I sat down and began to just take the liberty of transposing, instead of the they and them, it was well, we and us and I, and I'm telling you the story, it just exploded to me. Some of it was like, it was a revelation. I'm reading going, oh, wow, that's what he's saying. Have you ever had that sort of an experience where, I finally get what he's talking about? So this became such a passion. I wanted to share this first-person account of history. So what I did was select various passages. And
and commit to memory as best I can. Those things that most people want to know about, most Americans need to know about the Pilgrim story. Most of what we know about the Pilgrims comes, from, as you probably know, from the writings of at least the first person accounts, some from William Bradford and W. Willoughby. And there's two things I really want you to take away from here today. If you remember nothing else, there's two things that are very central to understanding the Pilgrims, but also understanding William Bradford. And that, and those two things, number one is, you cannot understand the Pilgrims, I don't believe, if you do not understand the faith of the Pilgrims. Now, I know there's a lot of people, I'm in the Mayflower Society and whatever, they're in it for, they want genealogical accreditation for being a descendant in this way. They could care less about the history. I'm not, there's two groups of people. There's sort of those folks that are very interested in their genealogy, and then there's those who care about the history and the impact that it had on our country and our nation. And I'm a historian. I love the history. And my son has certainly picked that up, and he's spent his life, he's 38 years old right now, but he's been working in the history field ever since 12 years old, teaching other kids about American history. So it's the history that fascinates me. And one of the things I found very interesting recently, a lot of historians, especially, I'll call them secular historians, or people that, when they read about the faith, and when Bradford himself writes about his purposes for things, or he shares what God is doing through himself and through the Pilgrims, but this whole book is written about from God's perspective. It's like, we call it a worldview. It's the lens by which we view the world. And when you see things through the biblical perspective, you see God's hand at work, and you just see what he's doing and how you're happening to be a part of it. And that's not what a lot of the people who have written history is about. People get into history, but they don't understand the faith element that the Pilgrims had. To really understand where they were coming from and how important it was in their life was something that you really can't underestimate. And in fact, I would say, to the extent that you understand their faith and where it was coming from out of this Reformed tradition, the extent that you understand it is the extent to which you really understand who they were as a people, and certainly who Bradford was as an individual. The other thing I think I want you to take away from this is not just the importance of their faith, but also in Bradford's case, the way God used death. Here's a man who was extremely well acquainted with death. And you can see, even when you look through his early life, I'm going to just touch on him briefly, it answers a lot of questions, I believe, that people have wondered about and never really had an answer for. Like, for example, one of the common things that seemed to be missing out of the history of Bradford was how did he get his education? I always wonder, where did he learn to read? And he's a farm boy. For those of you who don't know the basic understanding of where he came from, he was a guy from Austerville, a boy from Austerville. He grew up on a farm. My father grew up on a dairy farm in Elma, Michigan. But it was farm life. It was hard life. But it's something that he also knew. They were wealthy, but they were landowners. They had several generations of land that they acquired. So he knew what it was to have things. And the thing you noticed about in life, the things that we grow up with, we can take it, accept it, receive it, or not have it. We can learn to live with it without it. But the things we grow up without become really important to us as we get older, especially if we've never had certain things, and it becomes consuming. And one of the things that Bradford had these things, so here again, God is preparing him in a very unique way by how he trains him up, so to speak. One of the things I was a little concerned about when I was, not concerned, but I always wondered about, have you ever wondered why he writes nothing about Margaret's death when she slips off the ship in the icy waters of Robinson Harbor? How could you leave something like that out? It's one of those things, that's a good question. What's that tell us about this thing? Several years ago, I wrote an article for our Mayflower Society newsletter addressing this topic because it led into a number of things that I think most people don't know about Governor Bradford. And I hope you find some of this important and edifying. But so, again, a couple of things, you know, how do we get these invitations? We learned a lot recently. I don't know if you've known, there's been a lot of terrific books out in the last 4 or 5 years, 3 to 5 years, there's been a number of really good, well-researched scholars that have connected some of the dots that we have never been connected up to this point. I grew up knowing a very basic story about them. And what I'm learning now is some of these researchers like Sue Allen over at Barnett and Scruby Manor, she's been looking at a lot of the connections, the family connections that go back. And it's tying so many things back together. And has come across what she points out as a very almost aha, well, that makes eminent sense about how we got, how we learned. I always thought he'd probably learned from the priests or something that were, you know, they were ones that read, and he's in a small town, he probably, well, maybe they put him on his way when he got sick. You know, when he was sick, he became, or when he was about 7 years old, he became very sick and ill with a chronic illness that lasted for years to where he couldn't work the field anymore. So they had to try to give him some kind of an education. I always thought, well, he must have got it from the church. He must have been. But now we learn his uncle, his great uncle, lived about a mile and a half away over across the other county, over in Tick Hill. And interesting, his great uncle. I always thought his uncles were both uncles, he probably was dad's brothers. He was like, no. His great uncle was Thomas. It's, in other words, his grandfather's a brother lived over in Tick Hill. And what do you know? Over in Tick Hill, there happened to be a school. There were common, there's only two in that whole area. One over, I think, by Gainsborough, and then there's one over in Tick Hill. And his uncle was there. But it's another interesting thing I want to say. You know, a part of this, I've been a little perplexed by the dearth of anything written about this, and maybe it's just that nobody knew anything about it. But the lack of scholarly curiosity or even reasoned speculation has left a vacuum that appears to be filled with only conspiracy theories or specious stories hatched from the imagination of magazine writers. Most of the writers in about 1930, 1940 started writing and going, well, she must have been very despondent, it must have been having an affair, coming up with all kinds of things that, well, it's, I guess, plausible, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you understand who these people were and the faith that they had. It would have been a violation of the most basic commandments, you know. So I believe the time had come to begin to fill that void with something other than fanciful theories of infidelity or suicide. So why did he neglect or fail to write anything about this? When seeking reasons for Bradford's troubling omission, I call this the Great Omission. It's my little title for it. When seeking reasons for Bradford's troubling omission, it's important to keep in mind that people's actions are rarely the result of a simple, singular cause. You probably realize that, but it's really important to understand that. We're always looking for, well, what was the real cause? There's only one real cause. There can be all kinds of causes, but there's only one real one. And I was in the safety field for years, and when we did the accident investigation, the fatality investigation in Los Angeles, what you're trying to do is really understand the proximate cause. What was the thing the last thing that happened that caused the injury or the accident? Okay, and then you start backing up, why did that happen? What caused the injury or the death? And then, well, why did that happen? Well, because this was bad. Well, why was that bad? And then you go, why? And after about 5 or 6 lives, you finally get down to what is sort of what we call root causes and also contributing factors. There's usually multiple ones, not just one singular actual real reason. Rather than a person's willful action in any given situation is best understood as the product of multiple factors, specific to a given situation, time, and place, and engaged in by a person whose character and past actions are generally well known. I mean, you ask the question, is this really something that's not out of the question? Is this normal for this? Is this out of character for this individual? Because people that know them very well. That's very useful information. So to make sense of the mystery, we must start by understanding that unlike an autobiography, in this writing of Plymouth Plantation, William Bradford was regarded for posterity a noteworthy experience of his church family that occurred over a 30-year period. His His journal was not a diary of personal thoughts and reflections, which is what we think of when we put Bradford's diary. Boy, he must have shared his heart. No, he was being a reporter. He was sharing what God was doing through these people. And so rather than providing an objective account of something, he was providing an objective account of something bigger than himself. This included time spent in three countries on two continents, England, Holland, obviously, and America. His journal centered on the historically significant events which God placed on his heart, along with the intents and purposes of the separatist congregation and later the larger community. He was determined to provide future generations with an accurate accounting of what truly transpired and why. He goes into the reasons why he's sharing this thing, and to avoid renderings of personal trials or hardships. This immediately comes apparent when you read it and find he's always referring to things in the third person. So any meaningful investigation into Bradford's seeming indifference to his wife's death requires us to identify important facts that attest to his character and past experiences with death, both of which lack the heart of this question. Throughout his formative years and into adulthood, Bradford would live and grow to be a man and extremely well acquainted with death. His father, William, was 32 years old when he died, when he was, Bradford was just over a year old, 14 months. He never knew his dad. 3 years later, his grandfather, Bradford, now the male patriarch of the family, and his model, he dies. So his wife, his mother remarries, Robert Briggs, has a daughter, and then another year and a half later, when he's seven, William's 7 years old, his mother has a little boy, Robert. And 2 weeks after she has this little boy, she dies from complications and infection or whatever. So he's now lucky by the time he's seven. And at this point, he's living in Austin here on the farm. And so he goes and staying with his uncle, Robert, and his aunt Alice. And this is when this illness sets in. You know, it's not an acute thing. It's something we don't know what it is. It's a sickness that lasts a long time, but he can't work in the fields. And so this is when they probably went over to Thomas, who was there with that town. He could learn to read, learn to do math and do things. In fact, the interesting school back then, it was a long day. It was 8 hours that started around 6 in the morning, went to about 5 in the afternoon, with a 2-hour break for lunch. And they basically learned Latin and be able to read and learn Greek and these types of things. So he goes to stay with them when he's 10 years old. This is 10 years old. His aunt Grace dies. I'm not sure I get this chronology right. 3 years after over the next years, he loses Aunt Grace, and then his grandfather, Hanson, dies on his mother's side the next year. 3 years later, grandmother Hanson dies. He's 13. And as if this wasn't, 2 years later, he's now 15 years old. He's supposed to die now. His uncle Robert. Or no, his great uncle Thomas, who he stays with over in Ezekiel. And then 3 years after, and this is when he's 15. What's he doing when he's 15? Well, remember, he started to get involved with the underground churches and learning because of what he was reading and hearing some of the Reformed teaching of Richard Clifton, some of these folks. By the time he's 15 years old, his great uncle dies, and then 2 years later, finally 2 years later, his uncle Robert would die. And after William reached his 17th birthday. So you got 9, 10 people, his whole family, the people he trusted most, and the people that he was close to, all died. Every two to five years, he was losing somebody significant in his family. And so he's getting ready to leave when he's 17, to Cootie Draw. His only sister, Alice, was 18 years old, dies. So now his sister's And this is the time when, okay, nobody's here. My family's all gone. It probably made it a little easier for me. You know, I'm going with my church family. We've gotten to know and become very close to William Brewster. He took a name like a father to him. These were all things that you talk about influences on people's life. One of the things I find most amazing about this is that it's like the book of Ecclesiastes. I believe William Bradford is probably very, very well acquainted with the book of Ecclesiastes. I always found it interesting because it was found in my favorite book. It's the book I've read, and I never knew this at the time, but I was thinking, it's the book I have read most. And a lot of people are not comfortable. I taught a class at our church on Ecclesiastes, and people were like, oh, I know, it's so depressing. I don't want to go there. It's all about death and meaninglessness and vanity. And it was all about the Hebrew hevel, vanity, this idea that life is a myth, it's vapor. Couple smoke, for your day, going tomorrow. We're never promised tomorrow. And Bradford lived, it's like God was teaching him, don't count on these things in life. They're temporary. And if anybody was a Christian man who knew that and lived his life saying, I'm here to please God and to be found faithful with God, and I'm going to live my life that way because I'm not promised tomorrow, it was William Bradford. And it's the thing that we all aspire to. I look at my relative, and I just—it's such a model of being the hands and feet of Christ. It's what we all should be, and we all need to be. I'm reminded of that a little bit later when we talk about some of the things that are going on. We've been hearing about the last few days that are going on in our world. It's important to be in the moment. You know, that carpe diem. Live. You know. That was what this man was always evaluating what is pleasing to God. And this congregation wanted to be that first generation church, live out the New Testament church to their world. That's what they were all about. That's why I said their faith was so very important. And you look at the training, and what does it do to live without all the people that are very important in your life? So I look at this, and I think, again, we also know through the historical record that during the teenage years, Bradford developed a strong and abiding trust in God and was dedicated to the study of the Holy Scriptures. His zeal for worship amidst a small underground congregation in England was evidenced by his weekly trips. He'd walk down to Oxford, and he'd walk home, you know, miles or whatever, you know, that sort of thing. It became a testimony, a powerful testimony to the strength of his devotion to God and the gospel of Christ. And I'm sure these pastors saw that, William Brewster in particular. To William Bradford, the providence of God was more than just a theological tenet or article of faith. His writings revealed that his deep faith taught him to seek God's purposes in the events and circumstances of his own life, as well as the life of his church family. As a result, when Dorothy accidentally died 3 days shy of his 7th anniversary, which is interesting, his parents, John and Allison, when his dad died, his dad's marriage lasted 7 years. And this was 3 days shy of the 7th anniversary, which was the 10th of December. She died on the 7th. And he was up scoring. He comes back to shit. He's no longer with us. He was 30 years old. This 30-year-old, spiritually disciplined and mature William Bradford would have looked immediately first to God into the Scriptures rather than his human nature to inform his response to her tragic drama. By now, his trust in God's providential care was so ingrained in his thinking as to be intuitive or automatic. Isn't that what we all aspire to? Us having the mind of Christ. That's what we all want for us. We seek it from the Holy Spirit. We go and we do things to train ourselves to think and our children the same way. By now, there was a reflexive instinct, if you will. One cannot read his history of Plymouth Plantation and fail to note the constant reference to the special work of God's providence. You know, that he's always saying, he did God this, and for God did this. It was always, what was God doing? He's sharing his perspective from God's point of view. So it should come as no surprise then, and would be totally consistent with his character and dependence upon the providence of God, that Bradford's response to personal tragedy would mirror that of one of the Old Testament prophets, no? Job, or how about Ezekiel? How about Ezekiel? In Ezekiel 24:15-27, God takes Ezekiel's wife suddenly as a sign to the house of Judah that there's no mourning for Judah for her sins when she falls before the Babylonian city of 588. God commanded Ezekiel that he was not to mourn, weep, or cover his lower part of his face, and was not to eat any of the customary food of mourners when God chose to deprive him of his, quote, the delight of his eyes. And I have every reason to believe that Dorothy was the delight of his eyes. It wasn't a matter of, they were all affected by worldly concerns, or they would have never made that journey in the first place. In the same way that Ezekiel's lack of mourning was to serve as a testimony to all of Judah of the trust in God's purposes, Bradford's apparent restraint and mourning could also bear witness to all his time and both saints and strangers of his trust in the good purposes of God in choosing not to create a permanent record of the personal sorrow and despair. He may have chosen instead, like Ezekiel before him, to glorify God and explain God's care to the world in the midst of his suffering. I'd like to share with you just this, kind of give you from his word. You know, Bradford is a poet. You know that he wrote a number of poems. Some of them aren't very good. They're kind of like, okay, who wrote this? Johnny? But one was particularly just impactful to me. It's a favorite one, but one of the things it does is it captures, this is his poem called Epitaphium Mea. My epitaph. He wrote it right before he died. And it's his perspective on what his life meant or what God had done to his life. And I'm not going to read this in dialect because I want you to listen to the words. There's some very striking and important things he says in here. But this is Bradford's self-account, what he believed, his epitaph. He said, from my years young, in days of youth, God did make known to me his truth, and called me from my needy place, for to enjoy the means of grace. In wilderness he did me guide, and in strange lands for me provide. In fears and wants, through weal and woe, as pilgrim passes I to and fro. Oft left of them whom I did trust, how vain it is to rest on dust. A man of sorrows I have been, and many changes I have seen. Wars, wants, peace, plenty have I known, and some events and others thrown down. The humble, poor, cheerful, and glad, rich, discontent, sober, and sad. When fears with sorrows have been mixed, consolations became the trace. Faint not, poor soul, in God still trust. Fear not the things thou suffer must. For whom he loves, he doth chastise. And then all tears wipes from their eyes. Farewell, dear children, whom I love. Your better father is above. When I am gone, he can supply, and he will bless you all your days. My days are spent, old age is come. My strength it fails, my glass near run. Now I will wait when work is done, until my happy change shall come. When from my labors I shall rest, with Christ above, for to you.
Those two
lines, just one reiterated. Off left of them whom I did trust, he's talking about all the people that God had taken away. And how vain it is for us to dust. Please, Genesis. step back here and stop and speak to a more basic question for a minute if I can. I'll do this quickly. I've been hearing a lot lately this past year, year and a half or so, and we talked about it here in the sessions the last couple of days, about the relevance of the church. The 1619 Project almost seems very challenging the whole basis of are the pilgrims relevant? We've got historians that have written for years to talk about, well, they weren't that important anyway. They were like a bad part of it. It was really the Great Migration of 1630, but really it's the common invasion. And also, what did the pilgrims have to do with that? They were servants again, eventually got swallowed up from the company officially. So it's like, why are we studying them again? Why is this important? And is there anything to learn from them to guide us in confronting our current dilemmas? Well, I think it's safe to say for the past couple of years, our nation has been enduring awful stress tests of epic proportions. Once indivisible bonds have been pulled apart, our American institutions and values have been stretched to a breaking point. I don't believe history will show this to be an overstatement or hyperbole. The intensity of the divisiveness and political acrimony, along with the autocratic response, national response to COVID-19, has begun to shatter our national unity and wreak havoc upon the American people. Yet we also know that societal collapse could not happen if our foundations were solid. It is only when the structural supports of our nation are subjected to relentless pounding over decades through the fissures begin to break open. There's an old saying, in the confrontation between the rock and the stream always wins. Not through force, but through perseverance. We're called to persevere. Benjamin Franklin was keenly aware of the tenuous nature of our newly established Constitution from its very beginning. In 1787, the prominent Philadelphian Elizabeth Powell asked Dr. Franklin what kind of government the framers were giving us. He replied, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." Today we face a threat to our republic not unlike the one faced by our nation in 1860. The threat included divisive election that was immediately followed by a great civil war. And today's most casual observer cannot deny the corrosive effect years of abuse and neglect has had on our republic. This has left our nation vulnerable to significant unrest and the potential for great upheaval and radical transformation. Foundational principles and values make us who we are as Americans and have always kept us confidently united. We would be wise to understand the secret of the success, or to the success and longevity of our republic before it's too late. So what exactly are the foundational principles that undergird our nation? And perhaps more importantly, how do we go about repairing them? Damage. These are the questions I've been hearing the last couple of days. After our author Oz Guinness refers to America's core values as the golden triangle of freedom, they are three interdependent elements that are uniquely linked with the DNA or structure of American culture and governance: faith, freedom, and virtue. Faith, freedom, and virtue, like a triangle. And these elements are interdependent and indivisible. Each one is mutually dependent upon the other two for the whole to work or even to exist. To the extent that one is attacked, undermined, or destroyed, all three are weakened equally or broken entirely. Look at each one real quickly. Faith requires, it needs to have freedom and virtue. No one will genuinely embrace a faith that's forced upon them. I mean, that's absurd. True convictions must be arrived at freely, without coercion, the result of authentic belief and conscience. And faith requires fidelity to the truth and pursuit of holiness and equal justice under the law. George Washington declared in his farewell address, "Of all the dispositions which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness, these firmest props of the duties of men and citizens." John Adams echoed this sentiment, saying, "Our Constitution is made only for our moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of the other." And virtue, it requires faith and freedom. Only a person recognizes their accountability to an authority higher than man or some constituency can be trusted to think and act righteously or in ways that voluntarily subject their self-interest to the interests of others. Virtue is an act of the will of free men and women that cannot be coerced under threat of punishment. Freedom requires virtue and faith. Freedom cannot exist where vice and iniquity are uncontrolled. Unconstrained liberty without virtue results in anarchy, not freedom. To live free from the rule of men requires submission and obedience to a higher authority. It requires self-discipline, self-control, and the moral discipline to do what is right. Protopos of liberty cannot be established without morality, nor morality without faith. That link. Those things are all connected. Franklin agreed and even went further when he said only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become more corrupt and vicious, they're more in need of masters. So, it gets back to what do the pilgrims, here's the thing I want you to take away from this. What do the pilgrims have to do with the founding of Americans and the nation? Well, what we see in the pilgrims is the expression and historical precedent for each one of these three indispensable supports. Why are the pilgrims important? Because they embody these three essential ingredients. You think about how do they do that? Well, through faith. I mean, they exemplify faith. Bradford himself said, "Yet I may not omit the fruit that came hereby, for by these so public troubles in so many intimate places, our cause became famous and occasioned many to look into the same, and our godly carriage and Christian behavior was such as left a deep impression in the minds of many." This is when they were leaving in England. This wasn't something that was hubris or arrogant. He was just saying, this is the fact. People recognize them. The deep faith that permeated the Leiden and Pilgrim settlement was well known even in their day. We think of something that we ascribe to them later. Future generations all wanted to go back and grab something significant. They were known for their faith in their day. And freedom. Well, what do I have to say? Freedom. They may find compact, self-governance. I mean, this is they brought this for the first time in the history of the world. They brought this idea of self-governance. And then virtue. Virtue is my most critical and favorite one. And I must, if you'll indulge me, I need to share with you what Bradford wrote about virtue, because I think it's the thing that we all need to understand is essential to who we are as a people. He made this very important statement. He said, "That which is most sad and lamentable was that in 2 or 3 months after our company died, especially in January and February, being the depth of winter and wanting for hours of other comforts, and being infected with the scurvy and other diseases, that the long voyage and our intercommon conditions are not so as their diet, sometimes food or trouble with that. That of 100-odd persons, scarce 50 remained. And of these, there were but 6 or 7 sound persons, who to their great commendation being spoken, spared no pains, night nor day, but with abundance of toil and hazard of their own health, fetched us wood, made us fires, dressed us made, made our beds, washed our loathsome clothes, and clothed and unclothed us. In a word, did all the only and necessary offices for us that dainty and queasy stomachs cannot endure for your name. And all this willingly and cheerfully, without any grudging in the least, showing therein their true love for their friends and brethren. A rare example and worthy to be remembered." Two of these 7 were William Brewster, our Reverend Elder, and Miles Standish, our captain, military commander, two of myself and many others were much the older in our Lord's vision. And yet the Lord so upheld these persons in this general calamity that they were not at all infected with either sickness or lameness. And what I've said of these are my sight of many others who died in the general visitation, that whilst they had health, yet nor any strength continuing, were not wanting to any who had need of them. And I doubt not wrap up here, and I would like to just, there's things I wanted to share about the, what can we do about it? I think everybody wants to know. That's like my wife. She's like, whenever it's come down, so I'm like, what can we do? What can we do about it? And so I wanted to include that. I've got some technical thoughts on it, but I'll have to share that another time. I would like to leave you also with the quote that's probably most often cited, William Bradford. You're all familiar with his main quote, where he says, "Thus, out of small beginnings, greater things have been produced by his hand, who made all things of nothing, and is being to all things divine. And as one small candle may light a thousand, so light ear kindle has shone unto me, yea, in some sort, to our all nations. Let the glorious name of Jehovah have all the praise." Amen. Amen. I want to say one final thing. I know some of you came here wanting to understand William Bradford. I hope I've given you a little something that maybe you didn't know. It's like, wow, there's some things in there that I, quite frankly, learned recently. And we've learned these. But if you have a question, please, I will be around. I would hate for you to come here with a question that you would hope to have gotten an answer to and you didn't. So if you have questions, I don't know if we probably can't take them, but I'll be around and I want to answer your questions before you leave. Don't go to answer.